Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
I'm John Batchelor with Professor James Rahm, who spent way too much time thinking about this. So I'm going to wander into this as if I'm wandering into a Byzantine challenge. Where did those letters come from? The book is Plato and the Tyrant, The Fall of Greece's Greatest Dynasty and the Making of a Philosophic Masterpiece. There are 13 letters, all of which are said to be Plato's letters, intact, outside of the Republic, outside of statesmen, outside of all the other works. The seventh letter has a lot of detail in it that we've been going in ways following the Dionysian clan. But there are letters that are said to be more or less likely. What's your opinion in general, Professor? Are there traps in here? Or I note that these letters have been argued about for more than two millennia, and there seems to be proponents of both of letters from both sides.
Yes, it's a very controversial topic in scholarship. I only offered my opinion on five of the letters, the ones that deal most centrally with the Syracuse episode, and I accept those five as genuine. There is at least one in the batch of 13, which is a forgery, which is not by Plato. So, of course, that raises red flags that perhaps there are other fakes in there. And the tests that we use for authenticity are not, they're not scientific. There can be no scientific proof of authenticity. It's ultimately a question of the weight of evidence. So I go into this in the book. It involves a lot of different kinds of argument, but ultimately, I believe that these five are the work of Plato.
The opinions of the letters vary as well. Karl Popper, that's the one you feature in your telling. He has a very, very low opinion of Plato because of these letters. Why?
Not just because of the letters, but because of the Republic. Popper wrote a brilliant book in right around the time of the Second World War called The Open Society and Its Enemies, in which he argued that Plato was one of the foremost enemies of the open society. And in fact, the Republic is a an argument for his own attempt at autocracy, that he wanted to make himself absolute ruler in Athens. So it's a very negative view, which I don't endorse, but I discuss in the book.
In the book that followed the Republic, was it The Statesman? Was that the last book, The Statesman?
The Laws is his last political work and his last dialogue.
Where is it that he advances himself as a philosopher king? Or does that never happen?
Well, The Laws has a speaker who is not Socrates, but is simply called the Athenian. And it's an older man, probably around Plato's age at the time he wrote it. And it's quite plausible. In fact, I believe myself that it's simply a mask for Plato.
So what Plato does at the end of his life, and I'm not accusing, I'm just trying to see the evolution here, is that that sentence where what we need is a king who is a philosopher and a philosopher is a king, Plato thinks that he combines these two skill sets. He could be a king or a leader, and he could be a philosopher at the same time. And he becomes the model. Does that work that way in history? Does for 2,500 years, have we come to the opinion that if only Plato was in charge?
Well, Plato never says explicitly that a philosopher like himself should be king. What he says in the Laws is very interesting because it reflects back on the Syracuse episode. He says, give me a city ruled by a tyrant. That's the place where the most reform could take place. And a tyrant needs a wise lawgiver to advise him. And they would make the dream team that would transform society for the better. And so I think he probably saw himself as the wise lawgiver who could be the teacher of the tyrant, exactly as he tried to do in Syracuse.
I'm not going to sound fair-minded here because I puzzle. Plato had facts that mitigated that opinion, and he didn't use them. Is that a way to read the letters?
He seems to have been extremely naive about practical politics. He ignored the obstacles and the pitfalls in Syracuse, much to his woe.
He used metaphor. I'm looking at the seventh letter. One of the joys of the professor's book is that it's endless amount of research you can do afterwards. There's no stopping, especially today when you can just pull it up on a screen. But I have the book here. These things Dion was now doing, writes Plato in the seventh letter, having preferred the suffering of impious deeds above the doing of them, yet being very careful not to suffer them. Nevertheless, he stumbled, having come to the peak of his overcoming of his enemies, suffering nothing amazing. Nevertheless, he stumbled. That's a very inadequate metaphor for what happened, Professor.
Yes. Plato whitewashes Dion's time as ruler of Syracuse so as to make him an innocent victim of the machinations of evil enemies.
He goes on in the same... The letters are so studied that each paragraph is numbered with a letter, 351AC, 351D. He goes on to say, the same thing also brought down Dion, for it hardly escaped his notice that the ones who brought him down were evil, but the height of unlearnedness to which they had attained and of the rest of depravity and gluttony did escape his notice? Really? Now, what does that teach us, Professor?
Plato was spinning the events in which he'd taken part, just as any political figure or public figure does nowadays. The seventh letter was meant to be circulated widely. It was addressed right to a faction in Syracuse, but it's clearly written for wide circulation, and it's meant to reestablish his sterling reputation and remove the stain of the Syracuse episode.
And Plutarch followed that same... I don't have the Plutarchian metaphors for this, but Plutarch was equally defensive. Is that correct?
Plutarch subscribed to the view that Plato put forward in the letters that Dion was a virtuous ruler who was brought down by pure evil.
James Rahm is the professor of Plato and the Tyrant, The Fall of Greece's Greatest Dynasty and the Making of a Philosophic Masterpiece, providing us plenty of time to look behind the curtain and see what's really going on in the Republic. Thank you, Professor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.
There's a time and a place for filet of fish, but breakfast is for sausage biscuits.
Dip, sit in the hip like.
McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.